I just love seeing you all come in like this.
He's talking about the new refiners joining the Severed Patreon page. Just $5 a month and no cranial drill required. Go to patreon.com/severedpod.
Okay, you're all set.
Severed, the ultimate severance podcast.
Welcome back, refiners. So glad to see you've returned for more Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast, and our origins breakdown of The Truman Show. I'm your host, Alan S. Our look at those things that inspired the creation of Severance continues. Last time, we'd just really gotten started on the 1998 Jim Carrey movie, The Truman Show. Today, we're going to really get into our deep dive. As always, horrific brain-melting spoilers are ahead for The Truman Show. If you'd like to watch along but haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a while, you can stream it with a subscription to Paramount Plus. It's also available on free streamers with commercials. It's a pretty easy title to locate. Last time, we were introduced to most of the major players. We, of course, met our hero, Truman Burbank, who is getting restless cooped up on the lovely island of Sea Haven, where he's been his entire life. There was Truman's wife, Meryl, and his best bud, Marlon. We also toured a bit of the town and went to Truman's job. The second day we were following Truman, he was sure he passed his drowned, dead dad on the street. The man who he was just certain was his father was whisked away and thrown on a bus before Truman could say a word to him. This time out, we pick up right after the bus incident with Truman visiting his mother. He needs to tell her about seeing his father. So if you're ready, refiners, it's time to once again open the origins file called The Truman Show. We cut from downtown Sea Haven to a shot of Truman's mother. The striking red-haired lady playing Truman's mother is legendary television actress Holland Taylor. Holland's incredible career began in 1970. Her earliest credits are of her two TV series and a TV movie. Throughout her more than 128 IMDb credits, the pattern has been to do several TV series, then a movie, then several more TV series, then maybe another movie. Holland's true love seems to be the small screen. At least that's where she gets most of her work. The Philadelphia-born Ms. Taylor was devastatingly funny as Evelyn Harper on 101 episodes of Two and a Half Men, but it was far from her only regular series role. She was a regular on 37 episodes of Bosom Buddies going back to 1980. She played Margaret Powers on 37 episodes of the 92-93 sitcom The Powers That Be, among many others. As usual, she is droll, in control, and hilarious here. Many aspects of The Truman Show mimic a daytime soap opera. Holland Taylor's performance as Truman's mother is one of those very soapy touches. She is only identified as Truman's mother in the film credits, but Holland Taylor also appeared in the True Talk TV promotional special. Her credit on the TV show was as Alanis Montclair. This must be her real-life actress name. I do have a quick update on the True Talk TV special. I found a spliced wire interview with Peter Weir from April of 98, about 2 months before the movie's release. In it, he talked about going around the set and pretending to be an interviewer, talking to each of the performers as their actor selves. This is where he got the interview segments we saw at the top of the movie. He said he also called Paramount, or rang up, as he said, about getting a documentary unit out on set to shoot these ad-libs. The result became the True Talk TV show, which ran that summer on Nick at Night. Since Nick is a unit of Paramount Media Networks division, I'd say the Paramount suits almost wet themselves considering the cross-platform synergy. Alanis Montclair has to be one of the original cast. If she's the only actress to have played Truman's mother, it seems she's also been on the show daily for nearly 30 years. Sure, soaps used to be on daily, but any star would only appear in about 3 episodes a week, and that was for an hour episode at most each day. Think about this monumental commitment. Alanis is playing Truman's mother 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 12 months a year.
It doesn't sound insane at all, Truman. I see him 10 times a week in 100 different faces.
The guy Truman saw really was the same actor who drowned, and Truman was able to recognize him all these years later. Based on the way they hustled him out of there, this actor was not supposed to be on set. He'd managed to sneak on as a homeless guy. No idea what he was planning. They were dragging him down the street before he could utter a single word.
It was Dad. I swear, dressed like a homeless man. And you know what else was strange?
Truman caught the fact it was some random businessman and the woman with the dachshund who grabbed his dad. Truman has a pretty keen eye. Mom, of course, is scrambling to cover things up. She says it's about time something was done about the trash downtown.
Before we become just like the rest of the country.
Explaining away the homeless guy while also subtly inserting a fear of traveling to other places. Ah, Lannis is good. I don't know about the trash downtown. It looked like the homeless problem was just the one guy. Although, I did find a deleted scene where Truman gives his meatball sub to another homeless guy who's in a wheelchair. It also happens in the downtown comet. 2 days later, Truman recognizes the same guy, only now he's playing a jogger in the common. Truman recognizes the guy's face, but the real giveaway, he's also wearing the same shoes as what he had on in the wheelchair. I think this scene was cut because it was just too damning. There was no possibility to explain away this guy.
They never found Dad's body.
No, because a hidden diver was there to pluck him out of the water without you seeing. Truman starts to pace around Mom's living room. He says if it wasn't Dad, it had to be his twin.
Did Dad have a brother?
Check the painting above the mantle refiners. Alanis seems to have the natural narcissism of a daytime soap star or the CEO of a multinational corporation. It's a painting of her, her hair tousled into a mane. There are also pictures of Truman at various ages scattered throughout the room. When they first cut to Mom, we can clearly see Truman in his graduation cap and gown sitting on the table over her shoulder.
Truman, you know perfectly well that your father was an only child, just like you.
She says Truman must be feeling bad because of what happened. Yeah, let's dredge up the accident again. It's pretty obvious Mom blames Truman for what happened.
But I've never blamed you, Truman.
Right.
And I don't blame you now.
Sure, but if that's true, why keep bringing it up? It's important to keep rubbing salt in the wound so Truman does not forget. Bad things happen to people who leave Sea Haven Island. Mom gives her little Truman a comforting pat on the knee, and we cut. We're looking at a close-up of a padlock. It's the kind with a dial combination like you'd find on a gym locker. A longer shot reveals Truman is opening a footlocker. He opens the lid to reveal a random collection of junk. They seem to be memories from Truman's childhood. There are a couple of toy boats, a stuffed turtle, a kid's strap-on holster like you'd wear to play cowboy. He paws through it all to find a cigar box with a hinged lid. In it are pictures, photographs from Truman's childhood. We see this is a Cremo cigar box. Cremo cigars were an actual brand of cigar based in Manhattan. This may have been a nod to the fact that the first versions of the script were set in a duplicate of Manhattan. The pictures have the feel of 1950s Americana. There's Truman in a toy Native American headdress. It looks like Dad might be carving a Thanksgiving turkey. There's Truman in a clown outfit with red dots on his cheeks and Dad adding red to his nose. Suddenly, the door to the basement opens.
Truman?
Truman hurriedly puts the cigar box back in the footlocker.
Doing down here?
Truman's busying himself with something on the floor as she comes down the stairs.
Fixing the moor.
Merrill stops at the landing. Truman is believably cleaning a part of the moor. He casually throws in...
Saw my father today.
He pauses, then gives Merrill a look when she says she knows.
Your mother called.
Merrill reaches up to grab the lip of the stairway opening. It puts her in an odd pose on the stairs with her arms straight up in the air. Truman acts distracted. He asks her what she wants.
I made macaroni.
She says this with a huge smile, still in that strange arms up pose. In order to perfect some of her product pitch poses, Laura Linney said she studied models in Sears catalogs from the 1950s. This arm in the air look might be something inspired by a Sears model. Truman says he's not hungry. Merrill seems to get contemplative.
You know, you really Somebody ought to throw out that mower.
She suddenly drills her gaze right into the camera with a big, wide-eyed smile.
Get one of those new Elk rotaries.
She came through that camera so hard with a direct gaze it made my head snap back. It sounds like somebody must have sold a big promo package to Elk Mowers. Meryl heads back upstairs, probably mentally tallying what she just made for that fantastic Elk Mower promo. Hannah is very good at these in-show product placements, but she also seems a bit on the edge. The Empire Movie and Entertainment website did a nice 25th anniversary retrospective of The Truman Show in August of 2023. In a great article, the author says something in Hannah's eyes is always screaming. This is a fantastic description of Mrs. Burbank. Truman pauses a few beats, making sure she's gone, then he returns to the footlocker. As he opens it, we can see maps are taped inside the lid. There's a close-up on the Fiji Islands. A corner of Australia can also be seen. Australia is the closest continent to the Fiji chain. There's also a tiny compass, possibly a kid's toy, stuck to the lid in the corner of the Fiji Islands map. They do a zoom in on it. I'm wondering if it might also contain a camera. Truman almost reverently pulls a plastic bag out of the footlocker. He takes an orange sweater out of the bag. As he does this, we get a slightly disorienting cut to two women. They appear to be in their late 20s or early 30s.
What's he doing?
Both are wearing striped shirts, blue ties with tiny polka dots, and the occasional daisy in the design, plus maroon aprons with shoulder straps.
See, they got rid of her, but they couldn't erase the memory.
The memory of who?
Yeah, exactly. Got rid of who? The waitress to our right is a fan. She knows Truman's story. The one on the left is standing in for us. She's completely clueless. We'll meet these two in just a few minutes. There is a great story that goes along with this pair. The shot reverses, so we are looking at a TV mounted up high on the wall. It's like what you'd find in a bar, because this is a bar. For the second time in the movie, we are now on the other side of the camera. These are more of Truman's fans and watchers. This place is called the Truman Bar. It's a theme bar featuring nothing but the Truman Show on the tube all hours of the day. They also serve Pen Pavel's beer and talk all things Truman. Hey, Refiners, this makes me wonder. Any interest in a Severance-themed bar? Maybe after we get a couple more seasons in the can, we could have egg and melon bars at happy hour, dishes of shriveled raisins and salted peanuts, Lumen logos everywhere, and all episodes of Severance running constantly on the TVs. There'll be a house cocktail called the Severed Elevator. Drink two of them and you'll totally forget who you were when you walked in. Okay, just so nobody steals this one, that's the Severance-themed bar idea. Copyright 2024, Alan S., all rights reserved. To the right of the TV, you can see a framed publicity shot of Truman and a special 30th anniversary show plate. Above the monitor is a counter, 10,910 days running, which means it's the day after we first joined the show. Christoph and his production team are slick. While looking at the live picture of Truman holding the sweater, we get a shimmery dissolve into a flashback. The shot starts on the seal of the venerable Seahaven College with the motto, "Knowledge for All." We can hear a trumpet playing off camera. The camera cranes down past a banner cheering on the Seahaven Seahorses. The trumpet is being played by Marlon. He's not good, but he is wailing on that thing. Truman is also standing there in a band uniform. Other members of the band are milling around in the background. The uniforms these guys are wearing are actual high school band uniforms. They were borrowed from the Blue Star Regiment of the John W. North High School in Riverside, California. Wouldn't that be cool as a high school band member to find out your uniform was worn in a movie by Jim Carrey? Truman looks distracted. He's staring at something. We get a reverse cut to a very pretty young lady in a sleeveless white blouse and a red skirt with a loose white crosshatch pattern. She's sitting cross-legged in the grass under a tree. She's got a book in her lap and is talking with two other girls. This is the character Lauren Garland. She's who Truman was asking for in Fiji. We will discover her name in the real world is Sylvia, but we don't get a last name. Lauren is playing coy, but she does smile in Truman's direction. Lauren/Sylvia is being played by the very lovely Natasha McElhone. We saw her picture in that ad in the She magazine. If you detect an accent on the phone later, you're not wrong. Natasha was born Natasha Abigail Taylor in Walton-on-Thames, London, in December of 1969. She left drama school in 1993 to play the lead in her first film, Merchant Ivory's Surviving Picasso, opposite Anthony Hopkins. Producers had originally pictured Brooklyn-born actress Annabella Sciorra in the Lauren role. She even appeared on a couple of early cast lists. I think the choice may have come down to an age thing. Both women are gorgeous and talented actresses, but Annabella is nearly 10 years older than Natasha, and she's even 2 years older than Jim Carrey's real age. They don't seem to be too hung up on making the ages all work out exactly, but this one may have been too big a stretch to even try. Cut to a two-shot of Marlon and Truman. You can clearly see North on the sleeve of Marlon's uniform. Truman and Lauren are locking eyes across the common, and it's getting a bit steamy. But hold on, Lauren's just an extra. She's a background player, not Truman's love interest. Marlon tries to distract Truman by playing the trumpet right in his face. Truman jams the feathered tuft on his band hat into the trumpet to mute it. He then smiles in Lauren's direction. Lauren returns the smile and the flirting goes into high gear. Suddenly...
Oh! Ow! Whoa. Ow! Whoa. Okay? Excuse me! Right. Hi!
It's Meryl. This is the moment where Hannah Gill joins the cast. Truman and Meryl's first meeting happened just as Truman was starting to make some time with the cute girl on the grass. Meryl has her hair in pigtails with a severe part down the middle. She's wearing a cheerleader outfit with a golden seahorse on the breast. Meryl is practically laying on Truman, rubbing her leg where she may have sprained an ankle. Truman could not care less about the pretty blonde cheerleader who's throwing herself at him. He cranes his neck, trying to get another glimpse of the doe-eyed hottie under the tree, but she's gone.
I'm so sorry I fell on you like that.
That's okay.
Hannah is good and aggressive. She's not getting any response from Truman, but she rolls on anyway, like everything is going great.
I'm Meryl.
Hi, I'm Truman.
Hey!
We cut to a college dance. It must be homecoming weekend. This raises a question. How would Sea Haven ever have an away game? Maybe we get reports from the team when they go to face other schools, but Truman stays home. It looks like Meryl got her way. She is Truman's date at the dance. This is actually Kristoff's way. The heart may want what the heart wants, but here in Sea Haven, the heart is trumped by what Kristoff wants. Truman doesn't get to make any of the major decisions in his life. They're all made for him by Kristoff. This is where philosophy classes get in on the study of Truman. The whole reality of the situation raises questions about morality, ethics in media, and what constitutes free will. Truman is turned out in a white tux with a plaid bow tie. Marlon is looking fine in a black tux. Check out Marlon's dance partner. This is an uncredited Melissa Fitzgerald. The reason she and Noah Emmerich look so at ease together is because Melissa was his real-life fiance at the time. They married in November of 1998. The marriage will only last until 2003. Melissa is also an actress, but she was just getting started in the late 90s. Her first IMDb credit was also in 1998 for a movie called Monument Avenue. Truman is her second credit, even though technically it was uncredited. Melissa will go on to have 19 performer credits. If you know the name, it's probably because she was a series regular on The West Wing starting in 1999. She would portray staffer Carol Fitzpatrick on 102 episodes. One of her just starting out appearances prior to landing The West Wing is also for an appearance on the True Talk TV show. I guess everybody was in the half-hour TV special promoting The Truman Show. I don't know how they fit them all in 22 minutes. Weirdly, even though Melissa is not credited in the movie, she is given a character name for the True Talk special. She's listed as Carol Cuthbert, which must be her real-world actress name. Just another reason I would love to find this True Talk TV special. Almost everything on the Truman soundtrack is either public domain classical music or original scoring by either Philip Glass or Burkhard Dalwitz. This tune we're hearing at the dance is one of the few real songs in the show. It's a tune called 20th Century Boy. Written by Mark Bolan, it was originally a huge hit in the UK for Bolan's band T-Rex. It would peak at number 3 on the UK chart in 1973. It would also go to number 1 in Ireland. This version is a cover being performed by a band called The Big Six.
But it's plain to see you were meant for me, yeah, I'm your toy, 20th Century Boy.
British rockers Def Leppard included a cover of the song on their 2006 album, Yeah, which is a collection of covers of 70s rock hits. In a case of poor judgment on the part of the Truman producers, Lauren was allowed to attend this dance. As Truman is swinging Meryl around, he notices the distinctive green balls on the bracelet Lauren always wears. She's dancing with another guy, but making eyes at Truman. Did no one from the production team notice the fireworks in the grass earlier today? This woman shouldn't be anywhere near Truman. I am sorry, but when Truman fixes Lauren with his dumbfounded in love gaze, he looks just like his Lloyd character from Dumb and Dumber without the prosthetic teeth. I'd better be careful about saying things like that. This is serious, Jim Carrey. I'm going to get in trouble with the director. Truman is so openly gawking at Lauren, it causes Meryl to look around. Hannah, as Meryl, ever the trooper, redoubles her efforts to keep Truman's attention. We continue to get shots of Lauren from across the room, only it seems like there's a commotion. A couple of older-looking guys in black tuxes are escorting her off the dance floor. One of them whispers something in her ear. There's a look of fear in her eyes as she's hustled out. Truman looks concerned, but he can't really say anything about it to Meryl. As Truman once again scans the dance floor, Lauren is gone. Cut to an odd shot. There are voices, but something is in the way of the camera. An unidentified hand moves a book out of the way. We realize our hidden camera view is coming through an opening in the books on the shelf of a library. Truman is seated at a study cubicle. Meryl is sitting on the desk facing him. Marlon's in the background of the shot wearing a Letterman jacket and khakis. This flashback must be a package created by the producers. It's been edited together to tell the story of how Truman met Lauren and why he's fixated on her.
Truman, you studied enough?
No, I gotta commit this to memory.
Marlon leans down to speak to Truman. There's a V on the breast of his Letterman jacket. It looks like it says Varsity Teams over the top of the V. There's also a number in black lettering down to the side of the V. I really think it says 38. If this is a year, I don't know what it could mean. 1938? Just 38? It's possible the in-show world of Truman has its own numbering system for years. We will see in a little bit that the newspaper has only been in print since Truman's birth.
Come on, Truman. One ice cold brewski.
Come on.
Wow. Marlon has been flirting with alcoholism going all the way back to college. Truman is dedicated to his studies. They can't convince him to join them.
See you later, loser.
Marlon gives him a friendly shot to the shoulder while exiting the frame.
Ow!
As Truman resumes hitting the books, he's distracted by a feminine hand in the next study, Carol. Hold on a minute. She's wearing the same bracelet with the green balls as what Lauren wears. A quick aside about these green balls. We are also going to see some green bath beads in a scene with a guy who watches the show from his bathtub. They look a little like these green balls on Lauren's bracelet. An IMDb contributor has pointed out that these green balls might be an Easter egg referencing another Ed Harris movie. I think it's a stretch, but in 1996's The Rock, a VX gas is used by Nicolas Cage's villain. In the movie, this gas is stored and dispensed in green balls that look like big gel caps or bath beads or bracelet baubles. This is an interesting observation, but since Ed Harris was hired so late in the production process, I doubt it's intentional. Truman gulps as he realizes who's sitting at the next desk. He guiltily looks over his shoulder, making sure Meryl and Marlon are gone. He then peers up over the top of the divider to get a glimpse of Lauren. She's wearing the orange sweater we'll see him with in the basement. She's reading a book, pretending to totally ignore Truman's peeking. Natasha finally looks up at Truman with her giant eyes.
Hi.
Lauren's whole face breaks into a smile.
Konnichiwa.
This is a Japanese word for hello or good day. It's considered more formal than Ohio. Konnichiwa is normally used starting about 10 in the morning until 6 p.m. Since it is so formal, it's not a phrase you'd use to say hello to a friend. Truman grins after he says it. Lauren looks confused and says, "What?
Oh, you take Japanese."
Okay, yeah, the character of Lauren is taking Japanese. The actress Sylvia doesn't know a thing about Japanese.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Truman sees her name on her notebook.
Lauren, right?
She acknowledges the name, but you can tell she'd kind of forgotten who she's supposed to be. Truman introduces himself.
Yeah, I know.
You're not supposed to say that, Lauren. She's whispering quickly, telling Truman she's not allowed to talk to him.
Really?
This doesn't mean anything to Truman. Lauren is talking to Truman like he knows what's happening to him, but he's truly clueless. She isn't making a bit of sense from his vantage point.
Yeah, well, I can understand it. I'm a pretty dangerous character.
She says it's not up to her. I don't know why she thinks any of this is going to mean something to Truman without a huge dose of context.
Girls got to be careful.
Truman interprets these comments from the perspective of a guy who's just trying to get a date with a girl at the library.
You have a boyfriend, right?
She says it's not that. He wonders if it was the fact she saw him with Meryl. He claims they're just friends. This would make Meryl cringe if she knew about it. Lauren keeps saying it's nothing like that, but there's no way she can get into why. He asks if it's how he looks. That must be it. He's not her type.
No.
Truman then notices the round white pin on the lapel of her sweater.
I like your pen.
It says, in all caps, Helvetica, how is it going to end? This is a pin that seems to be produced and worn by protesters trying to shut down the Truman Show. I'm very surprised she was able to sneak it onto the set. Truman doesn't have a frame of reference as to what it means.
I was wondering that myself.
I think he's talking about this current interaction. Truman haltingly asks Lauren out for pizza. Maybe Friday? She says she can't.
Saturday? Sunday, Monday, Tuesday.
Truman's got it bad for this girl. She keeps turning him down, saying she can't, with no explanation as to why. Lauren then scrawls a single word on the lined notebook paper in front of her. It says, now. This is a great scene, but it does make me wonder about something. After the producers had a dust-up with Sylvia at the dance, why was she allowed to show up here at the library? You'd think they'd want to throw her off the show immediately and not give her another chance to make contact with Truman. I'm also shocked they've been left alone this long without either Meryl or Marlon being sent back to break things up. Since this was earlier in the show, maybe the communication with the cast wasn't as good back then. Or, if you want to go really dark and conspiratorial, think about this. Maybe Christoph wanted Truman to make a connection with this girl he can never have. It sets up a juicy, angst-filled B-story about unrequited love that they've milked for nearly 10 years now. They've been letting Truman build her face out of magazines, so they must not be too concerned about stopping this infatuation. It also creates a lot of dramatic tension between Truman and Meryl. Could Christoph be that heartless? Well, he drowned Truman's father right in front of the kid. I see him doing anything for ratings. Ripping away a love interest seems tame compared to faking a death. Truman is very goody-goody. The pretty girl with the enormous eyes is asking him out. Does he immediately grab her hand and run out of the library? Nope.
We have finals tomorrow.
Lauren says she knows. She then puts a hand up, covering the side of her face. In a low voice, she mysteriously says,
"If we don't go now, it won't happen."
It's possible the TV audience didn't hear that. We may have only heard it as movie watchers. She asks him if he understands. Well, of course, Truman has no clue what she's talking about, but it doesn't matter. He is mesmerized by Lauren's eyes. Cut to a shot from behind a pillar in the library. A group of students is filing by. We see Lauren and Truman in this group. The camera is panning right, following them. They disappear behind the pillar. The camera follows, looking for them to reappear on the other side. The camera holds on the shot, ready to pick them back up, but they're gone. The camera quickly pans back to the left. We catch a glimpse of Truman all the way to the far left of the shot. Lauren grabs his arm and pulls him out of camera range. This little interaction reminded me so much of The Office when Michael and Holly elude the documentary cameras to have their first night of passion together. J. Jim Carrey said he felt he could relate to Truman because of all the paparazzi and fans who were constantly watching him at this time. The sense that he really was Truman hit home during his honeymoon in September of 1996. This was at a point where he'd been hired to play the character, but was still fulfilling his other movie obligations. While on his honeymoon after marrying Dumb and Dumber co-star Lauren Holly, paparazzi swarmed their island getaway. Carrey said he felt like he was constantly on camera during the entire vacation, just like Truman. The media attention may have been too much for Ms. Holly. The marriage would only last for less than a year. There's a cut to outside of the library. The camera pans across a parking lot. The director is trying to locate Truman and Lauren, but they have eluded the cameras for the moment. Wait, over there at the edge of the trees, just across the street, we get a glimpse of the couple running into the woods. We can hear laughter as the shot cuts to a look at the constantly full moon. Although Truman seems to know all about the geography of Earth, the phases of the moon must have been omitted from his curriculum. A tilt down reveals our point of view is from out on the beach looking back towards town.
Please keep your hands inside the car!
The happy couple runs down a sand dune hand in hand. The waves are crashing onto the beach. As they run towards the water, Lauren pulls her sweater off over her head. They stop down by the water. Here we're getting an over-the-shoulder camera shot that has to be our view only. There's no way Christoph has a camera hanging out in the air over Truman's shoulder down here on a deserted beach. He's good, but he's not getting this shot or the reverse angle.
This is my favorite pizza place.
Oh, yeah, right. They were supposed to be going for pizza.
Tony, one large extra plankton.
Truman is working hard to charm his date. Lauren is scanning the beach, looking worried.
Are they going to be here any minute?
Without any frame of reference, her talking like this has to sound a little paranoid. Truman asks her who.
They don't want me talking to you.
Of course, the unseen they. Without context, this is all gibberish to Truman. He's not worried in the least about this nefarious and unseen they. He'd rather make out.
Then don't talk.
Truman leans in for a kiss. Lauren reciprocates, closing her eyes and kissing back. We don't know Lauren / Sylvia's motivations when it comes to informing or freeing Truman. She does seem to have feelings for him, but these feelings are coming from a fan who has developed a crush on the star of her favorite show. He's more transparent than most of the people you see on television, but she's still only gotten to know him through a TV screen. The kiss continues, with the waves crashing in the background. This is very romantic. We hear a car approaching in the distance. Lauren's eyes open, and she breaks off the kiss.
They're here.
We cut to a station wagon roaring over a sand dune. The producers couldn't send out jackbooted thugs to break things up. The excuse for pulling these two apart had to seem natural and plausible. A father on the warpath protecting his daughter from a boy, that tracks. Only this father on the warpath comes with a twist. As the car is roaring across the sand, Lauren is trying to fill in some details. She's not doing a very good job.
Everybody knows that. Everybody knows everything you do. They're pretending, Truman. Do you understand? Everybody's pretending.
What does she mean by everybody? Everybody in Sea Haven? Well, sure, they all know about Truman. He, of course, doesn't understand. How could he? Lauren, come on, you really need to back up and give him some context. But there's no time for that. She does give him one more detail.
But my name's not Lauren, it's Sylvia. My name's Sylvia.
Sylvia?
Yeah.
The car has arrived.
Lauren, sweetheart, out again.
The guy playing Lauren's father is only credited as Man at Beach. He's being played by American actor John Rosales. John was born in August of 1944. He has 47 acting credits going back to 1976. Most of John's early stuff was on TV, like guest shots on Charlie's Angels and The Rockford Files. He started to do more movies in the 1980s. My pop culture-obsessed brain tripped a breaker when I saw him. Mr. Rosales will always be monumentally famous in my mind for one tiny 30-second commercial he did in 1987. I know you boomers have seen it, but you may not realize it was Mr. Rosales expertly slinging that egg.
Okay, last time. This is your brain. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
Unfortunately, John Rosales passed away in October of 2018 at the age of 74. There's a flurry of activity as Dad hustles Lauren into the car. He's a big guy in a gray sweater. He's trying to be calming as he pushes Truman back. She's shouting at Truman, picking up handfuls of sand and telling him it's fake. Well, fake beach, yeah, but it's real sand. She's not making a lot of sense from Truman's perspective. Dad is trying to explain as he's forcing her into the car.
I really would like to know what's going on.
She has episodes.
What?
We tried everything.
There's a twist on the jealous and protective dad stereotype. Turns out he's not mad at Truman, if anything. Sounds like he's trying to save Truman from his dangerous daughter. He says she's done this before. She's schizophrenic.
You're not the first.
Truman!
She brings all her boyfriends down here.
Once both Dad and Lauren are in the car, she leans over to the driver's side window. I don't know why he let her, but Lauren is able to get off one more plea.
Get out of here. Come on, buddy.
Don't worry. We're going
I'll
to Fiji.
I'll see you in school.
Fiji.
We're moving to Fiji.
Fiji?
The car backs up. We see Truman's face distraught in the headlights. And now we know why Truman has such a fixation on Fiji. I'm betting this was an ad-lib on Dad's part. He just threw out the first faraway place he could think of. He had no idea he would instill in Truman a lifelong obsession with the island chain. As the car is roaring away, Truman remembers something.
Sylvia!
Don't you mean Lauren? He's grabbed her sweater off the sand. She dropped it during the heavy smooching.
Hey!
No way they're coming back. Dad can't let Lauren / Sylvia talk any more of that crazy schizo talk to Truman. It might give him ideas. A dejected Truman is left standing on the beach.
But why didn't you just follow her to Fiji?
We've cut back to the Truman bar.
His mother got sick, really sick. He couldn't leave her. He's kind. Maybe he's too kind.
We find out he married Merrill on the rebound. A bar manager roughly pushes in behind these two. They have been glued to the screen for a while now. He says they need to get back to work. Besides, they've already got this clip on the greatest hits tape.
Can I borrow that?
Thanks to the waitress on the left, I've got a fun little story about these Truman bar scenes. The two waitresses are being played by Olan Jones on the right and Krista Lynn Landolfi on the left. Both are American actresses, but with very different resumes. For Krista on the left, this is the second of two total acting credits for her. She also appeared in the 1997 HBO movie Breast Men. Olan, on the other hand, has been acting professionally since she was 16 years old. She has 65 performer credits with one upcoming on her IMDb profile. She's also a composer, writing original music for plays and theatrical shorts. In about half of her credits, Olan's either playing a waitress, a bartender, or a maid. She's said before in interviews that most actresses make money waitressing while waiting for an acting gig. She says she's reversed that. She's made a career out of acting like a waitress. According to Krista, the waitress on the left, this scene was originally shot as a mother-daughter watching the show at home. After the film was finished, cut, and tested, it became obvious the mother-daughter scenes needed more oomph. These bar scenes were a rewrite. They were shot well after the rest of the movie was completed. Over on his workbench, Truman produces a framed picture of Merrill. This looks like it might even be a Hannah Gill headshot. I'm betting you could write to the show for your own autographed copy. He opens the back of the frame to reveal a composite picture of the woman he remembers as his true love. Using snippets of facial features from magazine ads, Truman has attempted to rebuild Lauren's face. He applies some of the eyes he ripped out of today's magazines. When he adds Lauren's real eyes to the pic, there is a quick cut to Lauren's actual eyes. She's watching the show. She sighs as she sees what Truman is doing. She can tell he's building her face. Cut to the radio camera. Truman's once again on his way to work. This is our third day in Sea Haven.
And it's another beautiful day in paradise, folks, but don't forget to buckle up out there in Radioland.
As Clive is talking, something happens to the radio. There's a digital glitch, and it starts to freak out.
Good driver. Good.
The radio starts to cycle, searching for a lock on a signal. We see Truman looking concerned. This is pretty odd. He attempts to adjust the radio, which is jumping through all bands and frequencies. There's a burst of static, then a voice can be heard that has the quality of an announcement from Mission Control during a moon landing.
Wait for the cue, background. Wait for the cue.
Truman punches the radio.
Countdown to action.
Stand by.
this has to be an assistant director prepping extras. He's keeping them updated on Truman's movements and will be calling them to action at the appropriate time. Why is Truman hearing this? He most certainly should not be hearing any of it. Truman kicks the face of the radio with his foot. A tip, refiners, kicking your dashboard is never recommended at any time, but especially when you're driving.
He's heading west on Stewart.
This is a street name inspired by another movie star from yesteryear. Someone much younger than I'm sure, has posted in the IMDb trivia section that this is a reference to Patrick Stewart. I'm sorry, although the good Captain Picard is an excellent actor, he's not a titan of the time period that seems to be inspiring the Truman writers. I would argue this reference to Stewart is a name check for Jimmy Stewart, not Patrick.
Stand by all extras.
The boy says he's going to be on them in about 90 seconds. Props should be making sure the coffee is hot.
Okay, he's making his turn onto Lancaster Square.
A quick cut to Truman's point of view shows us the street sign for Lancaster Square. This name inspired by actor Burt Lancaster. Seeing the sign causes Truman to physically react. He's jolted to the point he looks back at the sign. Looking away causes him to almost run down a woman with an umbrella. Finally, someone in production gets a clue.
Something's wrong. Change frequency.
Yeah, something's wrong. As they attempt to change frequencies, there is a loud squeal of feedback. A wide shot of the street shows they're all hearing this. Everyone, pedestrians, cars, they all stop in their tracks. You can see people grab their ears as the squeal continues. Suddenly, Clive is back trying to smooth things over. The squeal fades. The radio is once again set to 97.5 on the FM band.
Ouch. Sorry about that, folks. I guess we picked up a police frequency or something. It sometimes happens, and it can drive you crazy.
This is supposed to explain away whatever that was to Truman, but those announcements he heard were specifically about him. He parks his car with a just what the heck is going on here face. He looks over his shoulder, scanning the folks on the street. He then puts his hand up by his head, looking frazzled and suspicious. We cut to a close-up of the front page of today's paper. It's another message specifically directed at Truman. The headline reads, Crackdown on Homeless, in 72-point all caps. The subhead, Sea Haven Island City Fathers Say Enough is Enough. The article header says, Officials respond to public outcry over nagging problem. The full color above the fold photo accompanying the story shows a man in either a cop or security guard uniform escorting a stereotypical homeless guy with a long beard and ratty clothes. He's pushing him along in front of a Sea Haven bus, most likely getting ready to push him on board, the same way Truman's dad was. The article is the lead, but there is some great info in the header of this shot of the Island Times. The volume is Roman numeral XXIX, so 29. The number is 10,765. Normally, a new year would be a new volume, and you start renumbering each new volume at one. These guys appear to have been counting every day since the paper began publication. We know this is now day number 10,911 of the show, according to the information we were given both in the open and at the Truman Bar. So either this newspaper was started 145 days after Truman was born, or, and here's where we mesh back into that conspiracy theory, they might have two different timelines jumbled up in this story. 30 rewrites, remember. Maybe a few things didn't get corrected. The number on the newspaper is a difference between the number we were told at the top of the show of just under 5 months. That's about the offset between the day we think it is and the day those guards are showing on their calendar. So maybe both timelines were in place at different times during the evolution of the script. It's possible they missed this detail when they decided to go with the 10,909 number. I'm sorry, I know, I promised I wouldn't do any more on the timeline. Truman does a double take as he passes by this homeless crackdown headline. He doesn't stop at Earl's newspaper stand this morning. Earl looks worriedly after him as he passes. Any deviation from the regular routine is a cause for concern. Truman appears distracted as he moves along one of the wide sidewalks of Sea Haven. He's looking back over his shoulder. When he arrives at his building, he doesn't go in. Instead, he does a double pass through the rotating doors with a pensive look on his face. After doing two complete rotations, he steps back outside of the building. He can't shake this sense that somehow everyone is watching him. A camera from way down the common area jostles then zooms in on Truman. This is new territory for the production crew. He usually goes through the door and into the building. No need to keep the exterior telephoto lens on standby after Truman goes in. Truman is looking a little like Neo after his first time back in the Matrix once he knows the truth about existence. Truman is seeing reality for the first time, or at least he thinks he is. No one is looking at him or talking to him. It's not obvious, but he can feel it. Truman pauses behind a light pole, then kneels down to tie a shoelace. As he's kneeling, he is suspiciously peering around. He slowly retraces his steps along the wide sidewalk. We cut to a unique shot. It's the reflection in a car's side view mirror, following Truman. With this many eyes on him, it's no wonder Truman is paranoid. An idyllic couple of bicycles goes wheeling past. The man on the bike on the left is in a cap and carrying a briefcase. As Truman has a seat at one of the round tables in the common, I want to mention something about a mental condition that has been identified as Truman Syndrome. It was first widely reported in a 2008 New York Times article. Psychologists in both Britain and the U.S. said they'd been treating a number of patients identified as schizophrenic who were experiencing a Truman-like delusion. They thought they were the unwitting stars of TV shows about their lives, and they firmly believed everyone was in on it, including the doctors trying to treat them. One man climbed the Statue of Liberty believing he would meet his high school girlfriend at the top. He was convinced meeting the girlfriend was the key to him being allowed to leave the show. An article from September of 2013 in the New Yorker magazine reported on a student from Ohio who had suffered from the Truman Show delusion for years. The article was titled Unreality Star. Truman's the only person in the world who is actually experiencing Truman Syndrome. This is really happening to him. Not surprisingly, he's having trouble believing what he thinks he's seeing. He scans the tables at the Common, focusing in on different people seated there. Don't miss a cool seaside celebrity cameo at about 36 minutes and 32 seconds. The guy in the tan fedora with the red band, round glasses, and gray beard is Robert Davis. The woman seated with him in the dark hat and black nautical collared dress is his wife, Daryl. This is the couple who invented the real Seaside, Florida. It was built on a tract of land willed to Robert. Remember the operative reading the paper from earlier? Well, he's back. He is revealed across the street after a Sea Haven bus passes by. Although not very good at it, he's keeping a close eye on Truman until he thinks Truman is looking. Then he ducks his head and walks away. Agitated, Truman grabs his briefcase and quickly heads off to cross the street. He's starting to act a bit panicky. Without looking, he steps right in front of one of the Sea Haven shuttle coaches. The driver, who was surely keeping an eye out for Truman, stops short without touching him. This gives Truman a sense of power. He should have been splattered by that thing, but he was able to stop a bus just by his presence. Truman holds up his left hand, palm towards the bus. His will is holding it back. He continues across the street. We get a down-angle shot showing a blue-green sedan screeching to a stop as Truman crosses in front of it. Truman holds up his right hand with briefcase out towards the sedan. Truman is beginning to realize he might be the most powerful being in this universe. Truman turns in a circle on the center line, both arms still extended, palms out. Truman slowly begins to walk down the street. Then, suddenly, he sprints. He cuts back, sprinting the other way. He pushes open a glass door, running into what looks like the lobby of a large office building. There's a guard's desk and what might be a video directory of the building. The lobby is populated with extras. All are in business attire. A man holding a briefcase is talking to a woman who's wearing a dress with a tie. The guards, who are wearing blazers with an Omnicom patch on it, are suddenly aware that Truman is in the building. They look pretty freaked. One of them grabs a landline phone. The other is touching a communicator in his ear. Truman heads to the elevators. The door is about to close as he pushes the button. Too late. It closes and goes on. Truman steps down to the next elevator. The floor indicator is showing it at L2 and coming down. One of the security guards approaches.
Can I help?
A woman is standing next to Truman, also waiting on the elevator door to open. The guard has grabbed Truman by the elbow and spun him away from the door. Truman claims he has an appointment at Gable Enterprises. The security guard says they went bust almost before Truman can get the name out of his mouth. When the elevator door opens behind Truman, we can see there's nothing nothing behind it. This elevator has had the back panel moved out of the way. The elevator now leads to a backstage area for performers. There's a craft services table with a coffee urn and donuts. There's a cooler under the table and a woman sitting in a director-style chair reading a magazine or possibly a script. This reminds me of the stories I've heard about the backstage areas at Disney theme parks. Performers can only take off a costume head or drop a character act when they are in these backstage areas. The group around this food table disperses when they realize they've been caught. A guy in a dark gray jumpsuit wearing a headset moves the back panel of the elevator into place, but it's too late. Truman got quite an eyeful.
What's happened?
Nothing.
Truman is hustled away by both guards while looking over his shoulder. The guards claim they're remodeling. Truman, resisting, says no, they're not. He gets progressively more agitated as the guards push him out the door.
Don't tell me what's happening. I'll report you!
Truman is deposited on the street. The reason? He's told he's trespassing. On the street, Truman walks past a guy who is up on a ladder wearing a work belt. Truman smacks the guy hard on the butt with his briefcase. He then runs off. The guy doesn't react at all. After a shot like that, you'd expect this guy to come down off the ladder and give chase. There's nothing. No movement. No reaction. The extras have been instructed not to speak to or react to Truman if they can at all help it. This is a lot like a real movie set. Extras, who are paid by how much they speak, are usually instructed to not speak to or interact with any of the stars. Even if the lead of a movie tries to ad-lib with an extra, the extra will just smile and nod because they've been told by the director to not speak. Truman is on the verge of a panic attack. He's standing in the middle of the street, hugging his briefcase, when he spots the goodies delivery truck. Like most things on Sea Haven, it's a miniature. This truck looks like an enclosed golf cart. Truman's good buddy Marlin is the guy who keeps the goodies vending machine stocked all over Sea Haven. Truman runs to the market where Marlin is working. He needs to talk to his friend about the morning's weird happenings. We cut to a camera mounted inside the vending machine where Marlin is working. We can see Truman enter in the background.
Marlin!
Marlin turns and asks Truman what he's doing here.
It's a bad time, okay? I'm way behind.
Truman says he's on to something. Something big.
You okay? You look like shit.
Truman thinks he's mixed up in something.
Mixed up in what?
Truman tries to describe the morning's weird happenings. He's so overcome, he starts stammering and pacing. When he paces away, Marlin quickly reaches into the vending machine and grabs a handful of the candy bars he'd just placed. He needs more bars to put in the machine, but he doesn't want to ruin the shot. Marlin's job isn't really stocking vending machines. It's being Truman's best buddy. Like the trooper he is, Lewis Coltrane doesn't stop Truman in the middle of his story so he can go out to the truck and get more candy bars. Nope, he just grabs a handful to place again so Truman will keep talking.
The people on the elevator, there was no backing on it.
He does sound nuts as he describes an elevator with a fake front and people behind the wall. Oh, yeah, there was also the radio on the way to work.
Start to, like, follow me along. I'm talking about everything that I'm doing.
Marlin just laughs it off, saying this must be one of Truman's fantasies. Truman thinks it might be about his dad.
Your dad?
I think he's alive.
This gets Marlin's attention. Truman says he'll tell him about it later. Right now, he's pretty sure he's being followed.
I'm definitely being followed.
Marlin wants to know who is following Truman.
It's hard to tell. They look just like regular people.
This is textbook paranoia and schizophrenic behavior. It sounds pretty crazy to say everyone on the street is an agent and they're all watching me. Except in Truman's case, it's true. If he were anywhere other than inside a massive studio built to fake his whole existence, you'd say he was crazy. Marlin scans the market. There's a guy in a gray suit over a red sweater vest with a tie. He's making a produce selection. This might be the same guy we saw on the bike earlier. A box of something from Zatarain's is visible in his basket. We then cut to a stock guy on a ladder. He's next to a very prominent shelf of Hunt's ketchup. Oh yeah, the studio suit who wanted real product placements, he definitely got his way. There's a woman in an apron at the checkout talking to the bearded shopkeep.
How about those two?
Truman doesn't know.
Could be.
Marlin is trying to point out how absurd Truman is being, but it's not working. Truman says it's when he's unpredictable. If he's doing regular stuff, you don't notice it. If he does something odd or weird, that's when the people around him don't act right. Truman drops his briefcase and turns to the room.
Anything happen?
Marlon says, no, nothing happened. This is exactly what Truman is finding weird. Something should have happened. A guy standing in the middle of the street, stopping a bus, or clapping loudly in a store, or whacking a person on a ladder in the butt should receive an appropriate reaction. These actors and actresses have not been instructed how to respond to an unpredictable Truman, so they don't do anything. Truman wants Marlon to go with him. Marlon resists, saying he has work, and besides, he just got here. Truman gets so frustrated, he kind of growls at Marlon. Marlon realizes he'd better go with him. There's no talking Truman out of this one.
You're going to get both their asses fired, you know that.
As they leave the market, Truman is talking loudly. He's trying to make it sound like leaving was Marlon's idea.
Okay, man, let's do it.
Marlon is following along, but he's not really understanding the cover.
Whatever you say, I'm game.
What are you talking about?
Yes, Siri! Birthday comes but once a year!
We get a final distorted shot of Truman's head as they leave. We are looking at his reflection in the curb security mirror in the corner of the room. I like to think this shot of Truman's twisted head is a visual metaphor. Activity continues in the market like there hadn't just been a crazy man in there moments ago, clapping his hands and yelling. I don't know what they've been doing all day, but we cut to a stunning view of a phony sunset. The very full, always present moon is visible above as the sun slips below the water. We hear Truman's voice before we see the guys.
Maybe I'm being set up for something.
Truman has this sense his whole life has been leading up to something. Doesn't Marlon feel the same way?
No.
Truman then reveals a little backstory about Marlon.
When you were hauling chickens in the summer for Kaiser, what was the furthest you ever got off the island?
It's weird to consider, but these people in Truman's life don't really live in Truman's world. They are actors, and they are at work. The key players, like Merrill and Marlon, seem to be residents of Sea Haven right along with Truman. Even so, these people also must have a life outside of the dome. This summer of chicken trucking was most likely Lewis Coltrane's agreed-upon vacation from the set. We're going to hear about other times where Marlon was away for sickness or a camp. All of these were also most likely vacation stints. Marlon's vague about his time working for Kaiser.
Went all over. Never found a place like this, though.
I do love that Marlon was driving for Kaiser. Props to Christoph for slipping in another advertiser reference. Kaiser is the same fictional chicken company with the poster behind Truman when he was talking to the twins. Marlon sighs, trying to redirect the conversation. He looks at the sunset, commenting on how perfect it is.
That's the big guy. Quite a paintbrush he's got.
So, is this a glancing reference to Christoph? I, along with several IMDb trivia contributors, think so. Marlon knows the real big guy for this place is not the same one many of the rest of us normally give credit to for stunning sunsets. There's a great long shot here. It's from the back of the rocky hill where they're sitting. The hill and the two guys are starkly set off as silhouettes against the twilight sky. There's a long pause as they contemplate the beauty of what's before them. Truman then tells Marlon just between the two of them,
I'm going away for a while.
You remember he said something similar on the bridge last night. Marlon shut him down then by asking for specifics. Although Truman seems to be intimidated by the thought of leaving, he can't shake this desire to get off Sea Haven.
Really? Yeah.
He sounds pretty resolute about it. We don't get to hear any more discussion on the matter because there is a cut to a full-screen picture of a surprised-looking baby.
Little angel.
I think it's later that night. Are we back at Mom's place? We can hear Holland Taylor's voice. She's flipping through a photo album. There's a shot of Dad with a young Truman in a captain's hat. Wouldn't want him to forget how it was his decision to keep going that got his dad killed.
Oh, my little clown.
The My Little Clown picture caught the eye of a number of commenters. Truman is looking through the spindles of a stair railing. Several folks have noted how it looks like he could be peering through prison bars. The implication, Truman's life here on Sea Haven is his prison, and he's just a captive clown entertaining the world. Just like Kelly's life on the severed floor, this place is Truman's own personal hell, but it is also a place where one could make a life. Big difference between Truman and Helly, Truman has no idea. There are handwritten notes under the pictures. When Truman was an infant, he must have visited Aunt Betty. I think we get an actual picture of a much younger Holland Taylor on one of these pages. There's a comment about a friend of Truman's who is only known as...
Old Carrot Top.
I don't think this is Marlon. A whole page of pictures is devoted to this friendship. Under one of the pictures, it even says, best friends, but there is no other comment about the identity of Carrot Top. As the page turns, we get a reverse angle. We see Truman as an album page is turned in front of his face. The shot widens out to reveal Mom in the left of the frame, Meryl to the right. Truman looks pained.
We should be getting you home, Mother.
So they're not at Mom's place. We then get a hilariously goofy faked photo.
Oh, hold on a minute. Here's us at Mount Rushmore.
We cut to a pic of the happy Burbank family standing in front of Mount Rushmore? The one they saw was quite a bit less impressive than the one I remember. This picture looks like they are standing in front of a 12-foot-high papier-mâché copy of Mount Rushmore, which might just be what it is. This is a faked picture, and it is so bad. Mom does manage to get in another dig about Truman's dead dad.
Do you remember Truman when Dad was still with us?
No, of course he doesn't remember because they didn't really go, but... You know how the memories of little ones can be spotty at best. Mom says it was quite a drive.
You slept the whole way there.
You can't overstate just how bad this picture really is. Photoshop version 1.0 was introduced in 1990. I'm pretty sure that by 1996 or 97, someone on Christoph's production team could have come up with a more believable shot of the Burbank family visiting Mount Rushmore. This picture must have been taken back in the early 70s when everything was done with miniatures and in-camera effects. They have to be going for the laugh here. It's a pretty funny visual.
It looks so small.
Yeah, it does. Mom is incensed about this comment. She hilariously flips the pages of the album back, hitting Truman in the nose.
Things always do when you look back, darling.
Meryl is trying to change the subject. She picks up another photo album.
Look, Truman... The happiest day of our lives.
It's a shot of the happy couple on their wedding day. They flip through more pictures from the big day.
And there's lots of pages left over for baby photos.
Oh, man, the pressure is on, and no one is better at pressuring the kids for babies than Grandma.
I would like to hold a grandchild in my arms before I go.
Wow, Truman's mom has all the subtlety of a needy tank. Truman turns his head away. He is resisting this full-on assault.
Angela, we really should be getting you home.
I'll take her.
Oh, hey, and we also get a name for Mom's character. This is Angela Burbank, being played to perfection by the actress Alanis Montclair, who in turn is being played by Holland Taylor. Truman starts to jump up, saying he'll take Mom home. Meryl tells him to sit, relax, his favorite show's coming on.
Besides, we have something to discuss.
A certain person's birthday is not far off, as we discovered from counting the days of the show.
Oh, I see.
The announcer says there'll be another episode of I Love Lucy, same time tomorrow. I Love Lucy is the grand dame of sitcoms. Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz basically invented the three-camera sitcom during 181 episodes of ILL from 1951 until 1957. And yes, if you did the math in your head, that's an average of 30 episodes a season. This is back in the days when shows were expected to deliver a new episode almost every week of the TV season.
But right now... It's time for Golden Oldies.
There's a cut which gives us a look at the TV screen in Truman's living room. A man in a suit coat with a pocket square and I think a cravat around his neck is seated in front of a green screen. He's hosting a movie presentation. The graphic behind him is for a movie called Show Me the Way to Go Home. This entire screen is created. There was a song called Show Me the Way to Go Home. It was written in 1925. In 1932, Max Fleischer did a 7-minute screen short featuring the song. It was a sing-along with a bouncing ball. To the best of my intense Googling, there is no other video or movie production called Show Me the Way to Go Home. There have been a number of episodes of various television series where they gave the episode that name, but not a movie that I could find. Also, none of the folks listed as starring in this movie seem to be real. I searched Lamont Ferry, John Nile, and Laura Harwood. They sound pretty legit, right? None of them came up in IMDb as performers. I also thought, ooh, maybe these are crew people. Nope, not there either. There are several minorly famous Robert Flynns out there, including the lead singer of Machine Head. Still, none of the Robert Flynns I found were actors in the 1930s. Our Sea Haven movie host is just on the verge of being fictional himself. He's being played by a guy named Logan Kirksey. If you check Logan's IMDb profile, his mini bio says he is known for The Truman Show, and that's it. His list of credits is one item long, this appearance in The Truman Show. He does a nice job, but Logan must have some other profession. Logan is giving us the lowdown on this movie, I guess.
A hymn of praise to small town life, where we learn that you don't have to leave home to discover what the world's all about, and that no one is poor who has friends.
They just keep hammering Truman with this idea that nothing's better than home. But I don't think he's buying it. The announcer smoothly rolls into a description of what we're about to see. We'll be visiting the idyllic home life of the Abbott family. Truman continues to flip through the photo album. We see a few glimpses of shots we didn't see earlier. There are Truman and Merrill hanging the sold sign on their house. We see Truman on what must be his first day of work at Sea Haven Life and Casualty. Truman has turned to more shots from his wedding day as the announcer takes us to the home of the Abbotts in Camden Village. Something has caught Truman's eye about the picture of their kiss. This is the big one, the You May Kiss the Bride kiss. There's a slow push in on Truman's face. His jaw is tight, and he looks upset. We cut back to the shot of the kiss. Truman is scanning over it with the magnifying glass his mother had been using. Truman does a double take when he gets to Hannah's hands. We reverse cut to the blow-up in the magnifying glass. Hannah very clearly has her fingers crossed during the kiss. Truman's head snaps up to the door. He is looking after Merrill with an expression of disbelief. Okay, so the crossed finger thing was funny, but I also thought it was kind of heavy-handed. He's never noticed that before tonight? Okay, maybe, but I'd call it a stretch. The movie host got me to thinking about something. In addition to creating and directing everything that happens in Sea Haven, Christoph's production team must also be running a TV station. We know they're running a radio station and printing a newspaper just for Truman, so TV kind of follows. They appear to be creating original video content while also running old syndication titles. I Love Lucy is cheap in syndication. All of the old black and white sitcoms used to be available to run in local markets for next to nothing. This was back before cable channels like TV Land or Nick at Night were giving them a broadcast home and new life. We cut to another gorgeous sunrise in Sea Haven. If the shadows are accurate, the sun really trucks across the sky in the morning. This is the start of our fourth day with Truman. Cut to a close-up of a hand adjusting a radio. It's an interesting radio. It's shaped like a globe with an antenna coming out of the bottom of it. Truman is adjusting the tuner, trying to bring in a signal. I'd bet he's searching for that frequency with all the specific information about him. I don't think the production team will be making that mistake again. I'm sure Christoph sent some heads rolling after yesterday's snafu. Do not miss an interesting detail in this shot. Look to the left of the radio and the orange coffee cup. There's a modern-looking supplement bottle sitting right there. It's vitamin D and 1,000 IU strength. That's a lot of vitamin D. Why would Truman need so much supplemental vitamin D? Well, it's because Truman has never in his entire life experienced actual sunlight. He doesn't know it, but Christoph does, and he doesn't want Truman to get sick. Our bodies produce vitamin D naturally through a chemical reaction to sunlight. If we don't get enough vitamin D, we can have problems processing calcium and converting it to bone. Severe vitamin D depletion is the cause of rickets, which will get you a square on the Egan bingo card. If you want to know more about rickets, check out the In Perpetuity episode of the podcast. In order to keep Truman at a healthy level of vitamin D, he's probably had to pound these supplements daily since he was a little kid. Merrill enters the kitchen dressed in her nurse's uniform. She has a photo ID on her belt.
Oh, thank you, sweetie.
Truman has quite thoughtfully prepared a cup of coffee for Merrill. Truman stands and walks around behind Merrill. He leans up close to her ear from behind.
I need to talk to you, but let's go outside.
Okay, so that was a little creepy. Merrill looks a bit surprised and possibly worried. To get out of whatever he's wanting, she pats his cheek, saying she's late. Merrill pushes past Truman, headed to the door. Truman has this strange, almost manic grin on his face. It's a bit eerie.
What's your rush?
Merrill turns with a plastered-on smile. This isn't going well at all.
Surgery.
She reminds him about that elevator disaster downtown. You know, the one that left the back out of an elevator and wounded people who appeared to be snacking on donuts. That one?
This cable, it just snapped. This elevator, it just plummeted down 10 flights.
It was on the news. Truman should have seen it. Christoph doesn't slip politics into Truman's world very often, but when he does, his swipes are deep and the enemy is clearly defined.
The non-union workers, just monsters. You know, that building, it's right next door to where you were. Can you imagine if you had been in there?
Truman doesn't mention he was just in there yesterday, right around the time of the accident, it would seem. Truman is nodding his head the way you do with a preteen who's wrapped themselves up in an obvious lie. You don't want to embarrass them by questioning their story, but you just can't buy into it either. Sea Haven is such a small town. Merrill, the nurse, is directly involved with this horrible elevator tragedy.
Anyway, I have an amputation on one of the young women who was in that elevator. She's very young. It's very sad. Anyway, wish me luck.
Hannah is flailing. All of the anyways are a tip. She's talking fast, almost stumbling over her words. You can tell she wants to bolt out of that house, but she has to supply Truman with something halfway believable as to why she's leaving so quickly. On top of that, she has to explain away what he saw in that elevator yesterday. It's a big assignment. Truman then delivers a shot. It's a pretty big one for him, referencing the photo album.
I'll cross my fingers for you.
Merrill pauses for a second as though the shot may have landed. She turns with a worried look on her face. You can't tell if she really got the reference or if she's just happy the grilling is over. Her face breaks into an enormous toothy smile. She didn't get the reference. As soon as she turns and disappears through the door, Truman springs into action. Not sure why Truman has the day off, but he seems to be free to do a little sleuthing. He is wearing a very plaid, very matching shirt and shorts set. As he runs out onto the side porch, he's pulling on a brown suit coat. A reverse cut through the front window reveals Merrill headed to work on her bike. Truman grabs his bike off the porch and gives chase. Cut to Truman skidding up to the bike rack at the Sea Haven Memorial Hospital. Check the guy on the stretcher in the left of the frame. He's secured into that thing with about 5 red nylon straps. Cut to one of the hospital waiting areas. A guy on crutches passes a person with a head bandage. Nurses are milling about and talking in the halls. What must be a body cam on hospital personnel approaches Truman. A nurse intercepts him in the hall. These hospital extras all seem very nervous. It's probably rare for them to get to interact with the star of the show.
May I help you?
She is so nervous, she's wringing her hands.
Yes, I'm looking for my wife, Nurse Burbank. It's very important.
The nervous nurse says seeing Merrill is impossible.
She's in pre-op.
Truman is not buying this. He was moments behind her. How could she be in pre-op already?
Okay, fine. Can you pass along a message?
The nervous nurse, hands still clasped in front of her, says she'll try.
Can you tell her I had to go to Fiji, and then I'll call her when I get there?
The nurse repeats the bit about Fiji, not quite believing what she's hearing. When Truman confirms she heard him correctly, she says, fine, she will tell Merrill.
Thank you so much.
Truman turns to walk away, but after 3 steps, he turns back. He had no intention of leaving the hospital without first seeing Merrill. The nurse he'd been talking to is already quite a ways down the hall. Truman decides to follow her. He's seriously wondering if his wife is really a nurse at all. He would like to see her assisting during an amputation, just to put his mind at ease. Truman is into a fast walk, bordering on a run, following after the nurse who'd promised to relay the message. Guy in a wheelchair is headed in Truman's direction. You can see the guy speeds up, trying to block Truman's path. Truman sees it, too. He's fast enough to get past wheelchair guy and through a door marked authorized personnel only. A hallway security cam gives us a view of the nurse running towards the operating room. Wow, refiners, if those halls were white, wouldn't this look familiar? Cut to Truman, still following. Suddenly, just like the pack of joggers from the day his dad was taken, Truman is facing a rolling shelf coming right at him down the hall. It's going sideways so as to provide maximum hallway blockage. Truman is pushed backwards until he realizes what's going on.
Here, let me help you with that.
Truman straightens out the rolling shelf and aggressively pushes it on down the hall. The orderly has failed. He's forced to chase the shelf and let Truman go by. We cut to inside the operating room. Four hospital personnel in full scrubs, masks, hair covers, and gloves are standing around a woman on an operating table. She has a leg exposed, but otherwise she's covered in blue hospital linen. There's an anesthetist at her head holding a mask over her nose and mouth. Another guy is holding a tray of instruments. Standing next to each other on the far side of the table are Merrill and the doctor. None of these people has any medical training, and the woman on the table does not need an operation. This should be good. The nurse who spoke to Truman in the hallway steps into the frame.
You sure?
In the outer prep room, Truman is peering through a window into the operating theater. Merrill's trying to calm down the poor extra who had to talk to Truman, then run down here. The doctor pipes up with a catch in his throat.
Scalpel.
Doc may not know what he's doing, but he's game to try. Someone else comes into the shot in the background. There's a weird silence after we hear scalpel. It's like the whole room is too afraid to say a word. Merrill slowly takes the scalpel off the instrument tray and puts it in the doc's hand. Cut to Truman at the window. He's studying every detail. With a very shaky voice, the doc says,
I'm now making my primary incision.
Guy playing doc, you don't want to really do that. He puts his hand on the patient's leg.
Just above the right knee.
Just then, a metal container clatters onto the floor. The patient raises up, completely freaked out by the thought of this actor about to really cut into her leg. Just how far is this guy going to take it? The anesthetist forces the patient back onto the table and pushes the mask over her face. As Truman is watching, someone comes up behind him and pulls the blind.
This isn't going to be pretty, unless your family...
The doc keeps ad-libbing, pretending he actually did something. The group around the table starts to pull on the patient's leg.
I'll just let someone else tidy up here.
Did you mean clothes, maybe? Something dawned on me during these scenes. On a normal day when Truman heads off to the insurance agency and Merrill is off to the hospital, this is when Hannah does her wheeling and dealing. Hannah, the actress, doesn't actually have to be there in the hospital set. It's not like they're caring for real patients or she's practicing medicine. I'd bet none of the folks we see in the hospital are in there on a daily basis. Just like the folks at the Harbor Ferry, these hospital employees only suit up in their scrubs when the hospital becomes a hot set. All day long, Hannah is free to do interviews, make deals, endorse products, write to fans, have lunch with her agent. The only thing she needs to worry about is that she's on her bike, headed back to Truman and home by the end of the day. Cut away from the hospital to a violent-looking poster. It's headed Travelers Beware with intense and scary-looking background pictures. On the left-hand side of the poster is a subhead that asks, have you bought enough travel insurance to protect against? Then there's a colon and a list of horrors. The calamities travelers are encouraged to insure themselves against include terrorists, disease, wild animals, and street gangs. The mind games continue. Remember, Truman, the rest of the world is a scary, violent cesspool. It's best to just stay right here in Sea Haven now, isn't it? Truman is visiting the Sea Haven Travel Agency. The camera pans over to reveal Truman in his travel wear. This outfit has a very 1950s feel to it. He's decked out in a tan windbreaker over a horizontal red striped shirt, khakis, two-tone loafers, plaid driving cap, and a red plaid suitcase. Truman is ready to go, but the travel agency seems deserted. I wonder where everybody is. We're looking at four empty desks. I'm also wondering why Truman would have a suitcase if he's never gone anywhere. Truman has his seat. The up-angle shot reveals another frightening poster on the wall to his right. A plane is being struck by an enormous bolt of lightning. The lightning has pierced the wing, and a spider web of smaller bolts are arcing all around the plane. The 140-point all-caps headline says, "It could happen to you." I'm surprised it doesn't say this will probably happen to you. Truman sees the poster and reacts with a gulp and clenched jaws. He's going to overcome his fear and go. To the right above a filing cabinet, we can see a map labeled as the world. It looks like an actual world map. I'm kind of curious where Truman thinks Sea Haven is located on that map. Truman sits, waiting on someone to see him. Suddenly, the front door opens, and a blonde woman in a red patterned dress enters. She's wearing a white square of paper at her neck. This is a neck bib. It's used by makeup departments on movie sets. She just got out of the makeup chair right before running onto the travel agency set. Since Truman is their only potential customer, the travel agency here in Sea Haven doesn't get a lot of business.
I'm sorry to keep you.
Oh, that's okay.
The travel agent has a seat at the desk where Truman is waiting. Her name tag says, "This is Doris."
How can I help?
As she sits, the actress realizes she's forgotten to take off the makeup bib. This has to be all new territory for both the actress and the producers. It may be the first time she's ever played this role of travel agent. She pulls the bib out of her collar and wads it up in her lap.
I would like to book a flight to Fiji.
Doris, the travel agent, is looking at a screen of DOS text on her enormous 90s-era CRT monitor.
When would you like to leave?
The shot reverses to what must be one of Kristoff's cameras mounted on the travel agent's desk. Truman taps his suitcase.
Today.
If you look in the pencil holders on each of the desks in the travel agency, you can see various miniature country flags on all of the desks. The travel agent begins to tap on her keyboard. Check the poster over Truman's shoulder. It looks like Princess Cruises may have gotten in on some of the real product placements happening here in the movie version of The Truman Show. Also, those round knobs on top of the cruise brochure racks just have to be more of Kristoff's amazing 360-degree cameras. While she's searching for a flight, let's take a moment to meet the woman playing Doris the travel agent. This is Judy Clayton. She's an American actress who was born in Chicago in 1934. Judy has 22 IMDb credits on her profile. Although her character is nervous about having a scene with Truman, Judy is probably very at ease working with Jim Carrey. This isn't her first time as Jim's scene partner. She had also appeared with Carrey in 1994's Ace Ventura Pet Detective. Judy played a woman who hires Ace to find her dog. Unfortunately, Judy passed away at her home in Miami in 2015. Truman is looking a bit suspicious as the travel agent continues to poke at her keyboard. This is probably her first ever portrayal of the character. Some folks, like Earl the newspaper guy, have almost guaranteed speaking parts every day. I'm betting bit players like the travel agent or some of the nurses from the hospital are used elsewhere as background extras. Then, if they're needed in their primary role, they can be carted over to the specific set and get prepped for their real job in Truman's world. If you look at the poster on the filing cabinet, the posters on the walls, the brochures in the rack, it's no surprise, but except for the plane being electrocuted, it looks like every getaway being promoted around Truman is water-based. The computer beeps a couple more times. Doris has to make this look good.
I'm sorry, I don't have anything for at least a month.
Oh, so close. Surely this leaving bug will be out of Truman's system within a month.
A month?
Truman's patience is being tested. He's starting to become aware of these ongoing delay and evasion tactics, and he doesn't like it.
It's the busy season.
She points at the monitor.
You want to book the flight?
For a month from now? Seriously? No way. He wants to get out of here now. Truman takes it in stride. He's not surprised. He says it doesn't matter. He picks up his suitcase and tells Doris he'll make other arrangements. We cut to the Sea Haven bus depot. A porter is wailing at the top of his lungs.
Last call for Chicago!
Although it doesn't seem like there's anyone in the place to hear him. Truman is at the ticket window, and we can see a bus sitting alongside the very tiny bus station.
All aboard!
Truman is anxiously looking over towards the bus. The ticket guy seems very occupied behind his sliding glass window. The porter then blows a whistle. The ticket guy hands Truman a slip of paper.
Thank you.
Oh, I see. He'd already bought the ticket. He was just waiting to have it handed to him. Truman hustles down to the red, white, and blue bus.
Windy City, here we come.
Truman says hi to the driver. The driver smiles right back, but after Truman passes, he shoots the porter a worried look. The bus is filled with an assortment of interesting folks. It's the group you'd expect to find on a bus from a 1950s movie, or a bus that might have pulled into Mayberry. There are a couple of nuns in habits.
Sisters?
There's a military man in full uniform. Several fedoras and ties can be seen throughout the vehicle. A little girl is leaning out into the aisle. As Truman passes by, she recognizes him. She tries to tell her mom she knows that guy, but mom tells her to face forward. She must not have been in scenes this close to the star of the show. We cut to a side view of the driver. He has no idea how to drive a bus. This poor guy is an actor playing a bus driver. Oh, and he's also the same guy who played the ferry captain from earlier. I bet he doesn't know how to drive a ferry either, but Christoph must feel he has a face for transportation. This is, in reality, American actor David Andrew Nash. David has 28 credits as an actor on his IMDb profile, but he also has 46 stunt credits. David has worked as a stunt driver and performer in both movies and on TV. He was a stunt person in Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, Creed 3, and on three episodes of The Walking Dead, among many other recognizable projects. He gamely puts the bus in gear. Ouch! Grind it till you find it. The bus finally stalls out. Cut to the front, and it's steaming.
Everybody off. We've got a problem.
Well, of course they do. There's not a groan, not a negative word, just instant compliance. Every single person on the bus stands almost in unison and gets off. Every person, that is, except Truman. The driver gets out of his seat and looks to the back of the empty bus. He notices someone is still on board. The bus driver may not be the greatest of ad-libbers.
I'm sorry, son.
He raises, then lowers his arms in what might be, I don't know, exasperation. The reverse angle shows us Truman still hoping to get out of Sea Haven. As Truman is still seated on the bus, we cut to a couple of patrons at the Truman Bar. They are in an animated discussion with the bartender.
Well, his father was from Chicago, wasn't he?
A woman dressed in blue with a glass of wine in front of her looks exasperated. Her expression says, "These people who don't know their Truman trivia, how can they call themselves fans?"
Dentist was from Pensacola. His father was from Des Moines.
Well, that's great, but it still doesn't explain why he's going to Chicago. One of the waitresses we met last time comes into the frame. She says he's not going to Chicago.
He's not going anywhere. He has to have it out in Maryland.
Check the Pen Pavel's keg handles. Also, those are souvenir Truman Show coffee mugs wrapped in plastic there on the bar. We cut to the view from Truman's driveway over to Spencer's house. This is the point where Truman really starts to spin off the rails. Spencer is leaving his house, dutifully carrying his trash can mounted camera. Just how often are they collecting the trash here in Sea Haven? And how much is old Spence producing? The camera pans right to reveal Merrill pulling up to the house on her bike. She and Spencer share a concerned glance. We go to a straight-down angle shot of Truman's Taurus parked in the driveway. Merrill pulls her bike alongside it. This is later the same day when Truman tried to break in on Merrill's operation and then leave the island by both bus and travel agent. He's had a busy day. He might be a bit tired. He's definitely freaking everyone out. Merrill gently leans down to the passenger side window.
Truman?
Spence is dutifully watching from behind, trash can pointed right at Truman. Merrill opens the car door.
Honey, are you okay?
Get in.
Truman is still dressed in the outfit he had on at the travel agent. He must have gone home, but he didn't get out of his car. Truman may have decided his car is a safe space. Whoever is watching him can't be watching when he's mobile, right? We get a shot from the back seat as Merrill gets in from the passenger side.
Truman?
He ignores her. He's adjusting the rearview mirror.
Look.
Spencer decides he's no longer needed. He and his camera can go back into the house. Merrill looks into the mirror. She's looking at the empty street and sidewalk behind the car.
What?
Truman shushes her. He's been sitting here for a while, it would seem.
I predict that in just a moment, we will see a lady on a red bike, followed by a man with flowers, and a Volkswagen Beetle with a dented fender.
Merrill dismisses his ravings and starts to get out of the car. He roughly grabs her arm and makes her look. Well, of course, his prediction comes true. Bike lady, then...
flowers!
There's a pause, then...
there it is! There it is! There's the dented beetle! Yes!
Truman has a weird celebratory, I don't know, cheer? After 30 rewrites, I'd have thought this bit would have either been tossed or at least somehow changed. I've got a big logic issue with this one. We know Christoph has cameras in Truman's car. He and supposedly the rest of the audience have been watching Truman as Truman realizes something about those people passing behind him.
You're on a loop.
They're like non-player Sims trudging the streets in an endless circle. So why didn't Kristoff stop the people from passing by before the looping became obvious? If nothing else, at least make it stop this last time when he's trying to prove it to Meryl. Once the pattern has been identified, Kristoff could have stopped the pattern. It's a fun revelation. I'm sure stuff like this goes on all the time in Sea Haven, but it doesn't make a lot of sense as to why Kristoff would allow Truman to realize what's happening. Truman's been watching this odd parade for a while. He says they go around the block, then they go around again.
They just go around and around.
Truman has a manic, wide-eyed look. Is he going crazy, or has he really identified some deep and strange secret about this world? Maybe both? Meryl desperately tries to change the subject.
No, I invited Rita and Marlon for a barbecue on Sunday.
Truman cuts her off, saying he won't be here Sunday. We've yet to meet Marlon's significant other. Meryl said Rita, so maybe named after Rita Moreno. Meryl plows right on through, ignoring Truman's comments.
And I need you to remind me that we need more charcoal.
Truman turns to her, pleading. Isn't she listening to a word he's saying?
You're upset because you want to go to Fiji, is that it?
Eh, so she has been listening, she just isn't acknowledging. She says, okay, go, just go. She then adds an asterisk to this statement.
I think you should save for a few months and then go. There.
Sure, let's kick the can down the block a few more feet.
Are you happy now?
Meryl decides this conversation is over.
I'm gonna go take a shower.
Truman punches the electric locks before she can grab the door handle. The reverse cut right here is exactly why you cast Laura Linney in this part. The smile remains plastered on, but there is absolute terror in her eyes. Truman is about to take Meryl on a wild road trip. They're going to encounter forest fires, a nuclear plant meltdown, and a bunch of guys in hazmat suits who chase Truman through the woods. Before we launch into this crazy sequence, I think it's time to take a break. We've had a long day, refiners. You need to power down, relax, spend some outie time with the family. We'll get back into more of the Truman Show next time, and I promise we will get to Kristoff and the control room in the moon in the next segment. Another quick request for your help, Refiner. The Severed podcast now has a Patreon page. Several more fantastic folks decided to join the cause after the first part of Truman. You can still get in on the fun for only $5 a month. Become a patron Refiner. A little a month from a lot of people helps me keep the servers running and allows me to devote my time to producing the Severed podcast as a retirement hobby instead of, you know, getting a real job. You'll find Severance Talk plus behind-the-scenes info and other goodies you won't get from the regular podcast. Find the Severed Patreon page at patreon.com/severedpod. That's patreon.com/severedpod. As for season two of Severance, hey, they're working on it according to Ben Stiller. Reading between the line, I think his very terse comment was also saying, back off, okay? If anything of importance happens, I'll make sure to let you know. Thanks so much for continuing to support these Origins episodes. Is it going to take me 10 hours to get through the Truman Show? Yeah, maybe. With single-digit temps and blizzard conditions across most of the country, what else have I got to do except churn out more podcast episodes? Keeping me occupied until season two. Okay, refiners, shut down those workstations. It's time to get back to your outie lives. Exit via the elevator, and as always, please stagger your exits.
You've been listening to Severed, the ultimate severance podcast. Severed is written, produced, and hosted by Alan Stair.
Severed is not endorsed by Red Hour Productions, Endeavor Content, or Apple TV+. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Severance, the Severance logo, and all video and audio of Severance and Severance characters are registered trademarks of Red Hour, Endeavor Content, Apple TV+, or their respective copyright holders.
Please make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review for Severed at Apple Podcasts.